Hi, Jeet.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. This is The Wright Show. You are Jeet here, Canadian Twitter gadfly and journalist.
That's what I've been called, I think, by you, but
Yeah,
maybe other
I'm
people think.
trying to attach the word gadfly to your name permanently, if that's okay with you. It has.
I think Gadfly is good. I mean, I guess I like to stir things up, and I sort of use my Twitter account to raise issues that I feel like other people aren't talking
I
about,
would say not
and
only raise them, but dwell on them sometimes.
dwell on them. Obsessively dwell on them.
I wasn't going to use the word obsessively, but whatever you think. So lately you've been dwelling, arguably obsessively, on the New Republic controversy, and we're going to talk about that later, because I have an interest in that, having worked there at some point in the distant past. But we're gonna talk about some other things, and maybe we're gonna start out with the Rolling Stone rape story issue, and that might lead us into various things. Bill Cosby, who knows, we may eventually segue somehow into Ferguson territory.
Sure. Well, I actually think that the Rolling Stone thing actually—I mean, there's an interesting tie-in with the New Republic, because I mean, as people might know, the Rolling Stone magazine did this, very attention-getting article about rape culture at the University of Virginia. And that raised a huge stink, and then there were accusations that the article doesn't hold up. And when there were these accusations made, people compared it to Stephen Glass, famous New Republic
Yes,
fabricator.
I remember Steve. I was
And
there.
I think that was an unfair characterization, actually,
Oh, totally.
because I mean, Glass was like a deliberate fabricator.
Oh,
He
yeah.
would take stuff that had maybe a
Yeah.
smidgen of truth, but really like manufacture everything, like invent people, right? Like invent, and then he fabricated the, and he was in charge of the fact-checking department of the New Republic, and that's one reason
I
he,
guess that's
or,
true. I mean, I should say I was kind of half at the New Republic and half not there by then. I was probably half time,
But
but
anyway,
yeah,
I
I
feel like.
agree. I mean, this it seems to me, my best guess is that if this rape story is fundamentally flawed, it probably still grows out of some traumatic experience that this student had, is my guess. I don't know.
Well, I think that's the important thing to emphasize. Like I want to maybe bring some like literary criticism analysis to this, because I think that that's perhaps the best way to look at it. I mean, so the Rolling Stone had this article, and then some people started challenging it, and then the Washington Post, I think, has done the best sort of reporting that really debunks it. And I think that one thing to kind of say about it is, just the style in which the Rolling Stone article was written, because it's a kind of, like the classic long form journalism that we're all supposed to extol, but very much, I think, in the tradition of the sort of new journalism of like novelistic, journalistic writing, where like you feel like you're there and there are all these details. And I think a lot of people took the Rolling Stone article at face value, and I certainly did. And I think the reason I did, and maybe other people did, is Rolling Stone is a credible magazine with a history of publishing distinguished nonfiction writing. People of the caliber of Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson, and Hunter Thompson. I mean, those were fabulations, but you knew they were. But someone like Tom Wolfe writing in like the right stuff, like you, it's, he's writing like a novelist. But you assume that all the facts
Are
hold
true,
up,
right?
and I think that there's that form of writing is more problematic than people realize. And I think that the, I mean, it's a type of writing that like writers love to do, right? Because it's like you get to be a journalist and a novelist, and it's a type of writing that is very powerful for readers. But if you look at a lot of the classics of the new journalism, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, or John Hersey's Hiroshima. Or Norman Mailer's various writings, or even Tom Wolfe's writings about Ken Casey, a lot of these have been challenged on factual grounds. And I think it's natural that they'd be challenged on factual grounds, because you're mixing genres. You're mixing novel writing with nonfiction writing, and and it's very easy for a critic to come in after the fact and say, well, this is kind of stylized, this detail is off, and so with that type of writing, it's always unsure, like, what the status is. And like with the Rolling Stone piece, like, okay, let's say they had done it a different way. Let's say they had done it as an as told to, right? I'm Jackie, this happened to me, this is my memory. Like, would it have been challenged in the same way? Like, because then people could say, well, you know, like, that's her experience, that's her memory. But it was done in a way that you felt like, well, this is like a...
Yeah, but, I mean, to kind of control our variables here, there's one other case you could compare it to. Suppose they had done it just as more of a straight news story.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that's where the flaw lies. It was a case of anonymous attribution.
Yeah.
And whenever there's a case of anonymous attribution, especially when the other the key figures in the story are also anonymous, I ask, how do we know this is true? And in fact, I kind of ask that in this case. And I should say, I actually haven't read the whole Rolling Stone article, but I read the first part. And then, you know, I was over Thanksgiving, I was at my in-laws, and I said, you know, how do we know she's telling the truth? I wasn't doubting her particularly. It was just as a journalistic matter, I was asking somebody who'd read the piece, where is the actual corroborating evidence? I would ask that about any anonymously sourced story. And my sister-in-law kind of lit into me. And it's like, oh, and you think all these women are lying about Bill Cosby raped them? I'm like, whoa, well, I'm just asking a question. And I think maybe, this is sheer conjecture, one thing that may have happened in the Rolling Stone editorial process is this is a very delicate matter. And if you challenge people's stories in this area, you can get some serious blowback. And this was a male editor, at least at the top, I don't know who the story editor was, dealing with a female writer, writing about a female who was raped. And I just wonder if he was as assertive in his questioning as he might have been otherwise. But it just seems to me they missed... And you know, I want to say one other thing. I'm not sure that this story is fundamentally wrong yet. I think just as initial reaction was too credulous, I think the pendulum has swung too far. Everyone's acting as if the story's been definitively debunked. I don't think it has. But I think it's clear that Rolling Stone just didn't do its job in the most elementary ways.
Yeah, you know, I think that that's something we can all agree on. There's a sort of journalistic malpractice. Now, I actually think, like, I think it has been reported that, and Rolling Stone itself said that they changed the fact-checking process on this story. And they, I mean, they seem to have been, like, a bunch of, a tug of war going on. And then at one point, and I think this is a real scandal, like, at one point, Jackie, the woman, like, asked to be taken out of the story. And then they pushed ahead with that and then got her back on board. But I mean, like, that's, to me, that's like very, like, you know, if you have someone who, you know, has a rape story and then at a certain point they say, well, you know, I actually don't want to go forward with this. Like, you know, like, you have to take that as seriously as a story. Like, you have to take their trepidation as a concern and not say, well, no, it's a great story, you know. and I think the other thing is, yeah, they did actually change the normal fact-checking process because she asked them not to talk to the, Jackie asked them not to talk to the alleged assailant, and they agreed to that, which is, I think, another problem. And
that is a big hurdle they cross, a big barrier they kind of breached there. Yeah. I understand why you're particularly sensitive in this case, but they should have had a long discussion about whether to comply with a source's request about who to talk to and who not to talk to. That's like, when viewed generically as a principle of journalism, that's pretty strange.
That is. So there's like all sorts of process issues, and it's a real shame because, as you say, like, I don't think we can dismiss Jackie's story out of hand, and in fact, there's other corroborating evidence. One of her roommates has come forward with an article that appeared in the student newspaper, just like describing what Jackie was like during this period, saying like she had gone from being like, you know, happy, normal student, something happened to her and she was really distraught, and then, you know, like, was dropping out of classes and had to go home. Like, which is, you know, like, to me that sounds like, you know, like that's not Jackie, that's someone who's seen her, and it sounds like something happened, like whether it's what Jackie said happened or something close to what Jackie said happened. I
Yeah.
mean, but I mean, that's the other thing though. Like, I don't think, like if someone's raped, like, you shouldn't expect perfect memories. Like, it makes perfect sense that after a traumatic event, someone,
Sure.
like is very blurry about what happens, right?
Sure.
Like we know that happens with, like, in war, in crime events, the witness actually experiencing an
Right.
event, like, doesn't make you, like, give you 100% perfect memory.
You're
Like,
right.
so.
And that's why I think the reaction, the pendulum swing has gone a little too far. I mean, people are seizing on things like she originally said five, now she says seven. Look, that's a little bit of an alarm bell, but at the same time, that is how human memory works in non-traumatic cases. I mean,
That's right.
it's like you retell the way human memory works, apparently, is every time you tell the story, that becomes your new memory of the story. This is a slight oversimplification. And so, there are various human cognitive tendencies that encourage maybe exaggeration and so on. So this just happens in memories reconstruct themselves in ordinary life. When you have a traumatic situation where the woman may have actually been drugged to begin with, naturally, it's not going to all add up perfectly. At the same time, this should have led the Rolling Stone to be more vigilant than usual, not less.
Well, of course, exactly. And I think that, I mean, there's, like, absolutely, like, at the very minimum, huge journalistic malpractice. But I think that that goes in with the literary genre question I mentioned, that if you have a, like, an experience where you're likely to have, like, imperfect memories, then to write it up like you're Tolstoy and,
Right.
like the voice of God, relaying these details with perfect
Yeah.
perfection, like, that's a problem. Like there's a real problem between the nature of the genre the writer chose to
Yeah.
work in and the evidence that she actually had. So I think that that's part of
That's
it. I
probably true, but I still believe, that the fundamental journalistic questions the editors were posed with would have been the same if it had been told as a straight news story without all the details and the narrative, and they certainly shouldn't have been confused by some sort of genre switch. I mean, they know what their job is. So
For sure.
I don't know.
Yeah, no. It's true that, like, I think, well, first of all, I think a straight news story would have, like, maybe highlighted these questions. Because I think reading it, you're not quite sure, like, your initial question, like, how do we know this is true, really becomes highlighted when it's, like, wrapped up in this sort of long form narrative prose. Whereas, like, if it's a straight news story, this woman says this, and this, we didn't talk to the alleged assailant, then you're in a sort of much better position to evaluate that, right? Like,
Right.
I think, and I think that that's exactly the case. Like, I think when writing about, like, something as serious as a rape allegation, I think the sort of, like, classic, clean journalism of, like, you lay your cards on the table so the reader can evaluate the evidence, I think that's the way to go. And I think that there are people who do that. I mean, the last time we talked about Gian Gomeshi, and something similar has happened with Bill Cosby, where there's, like, reports on rape allegations before the person is actually charged by the police. But there's, like, reasons, there's the journalism is done in a way that you can really take these rape allegations seriously, because the people are quoted. There's you go to the alleged assailant. People went to Gomeshi
Right.
and Cosby, and then they denied it, and you can record their denial. And so you're, like, in a much better position to, like evaluate these things. So I think
Yeah,
there
but
are
both the
ways of.
accuser and the accused were known. I mean, there are some women who were working anonymously in both cases, maybe some sources, but in both cases you had people who were on the record making the accusation, and we knew who they were talking about. It's a much simpler story for an editor. Like, yeah, you go to the accused and ask them what they say, and then whatever they say, we print it. That's simple. It's a lot
Which
more
I.
complicated when you don't know who the accused is. But you could do a little detective work and maybe figure it out, and anyway.
Yeah, and certainly you shouldn't have agreed ahead of time not to talk to the accused. I mean, I think that is, like, one of the
That
key
was a big
decisions.
That was a big bridge to cross.
And I think, I mean, the thing was, one other thing I want to say about the Rolling Stone thing is, though, that the article, like, there's this whole tendency to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And as I said, people are comparing this to Stephen Gloss. Whereas, like, if you actually look at the whole article, like, it's Jackie is one person in the article, but there's, like, other rape allegations in there that are, like much better sourced. And followed a different set of rules. So even within the article, it seems like the writer and the editor of Rolling Stone were following different rules within the article, right? And so I kind of like am worried, and I think a lot of people, you know, who are like active at the university in Virginia are worried that, you know, like what's solid in that article is going to be thrown out, like along with what's, you know, like on shaky grounds. As well as Jackie's story, as you say, this is being doubted, even though, like, it's we have, you know, pretty good reason to think something happened.
Right.
You know, if not what was described in the Rolling Stone article.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The, I mean, you know, the Stephen Glass thing, by the way, I thought there were more alarm bells in that.
Yes.
I mean, I'm working from distant memory, but in the taxi cab story, I mean, all of it was just a little too good to be true. There's an official cult of George Bush, if you remember, in the one story. But
no,
in the taxi
yeah,
cab story...
There's like a cult of Greenspan, that they're like these sort of...
Yeah. An actual religion, supposedly. And he had been to their, like, services in a hotel room or something. But in the taxi cab story, as I recall, he claimed to have witnessed firsthand a cab driver getting robbed at gunpoint.
Yes.
And two things, like... First of all, that's a hell of a lucky break for a journalist. I mean, you go out to do a taxi cab story and a guy gets robbed. But secondly, and I'd have to read this story again, like, if I'm a guy who's going to rob a cab driver at gunpoint, I think I'll do it when there's not somebody watching. I mean, it was, I, as I recall, Steve Glass was supposedly in the back seat or something. I don't,
this is like crazy.
You don't rob a cab that's got somebody else in it. You rob people when there are no witnesses and nobody to interfere. I mean, you know, I'd have to go back and check, but, and you know, Mike Kinsley, who was no longer editor at that point, was saying, you know, that just, you know, this seems, it was obvious to anybody that this was bad news. I believe the, I guess the editor at the time was the late Michael Kelly, so maybe I shouldn't indict the deceased in their absence, which is the only way you can indict the deceased. But
well, no, I think actually my analysis, and this is partially based on like talking to people who were at the New Republic at more junior level than you, people who were like interns and whatnot.
But they knew Steve Glass. But they knew Steve Glass better than I did, probably.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So there's a kind of, I think that it goes well beyond Kelly, like, because I believe Andrew Sullivan was the first one to bring Steve Glass into the New Republic. He was like an assistant to Andrew Sullivan.
Well, yeah, but you don't... I mean, there were no warning bells at that point. He seemed like a very nice young man, you know?
But here's the thing where there's an institutional thing. And I think with that taxi cab story, I mean, I think... and this is a point not original to me, but to Ta-Nehisi Coates of the Atlantic Monthly... the Glass thing has a huge racial angle. And then what happened, as I understand it, is that like Martin Peretz, the publisher of the New Republic, would be at these editorial meetings and he would say, like, how come all the cab drivers are like, you know, Africans from Africa and not African Americans? And, you know, like, do Africans from Africa have a better work ethic than American, like, born African Americans? And, you know, like, most of the other interns were kind of like, well, you know, like, they don't want to touch that for understandable reasons. But like Glass, who was like, you know, hugely ambitious, said, you know, like, oh, I'll do the story that the publisher of this magazine really wants.
By the way, technically, he was editor-in-chief and owner. His title was editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
So this wasn't technically a case of publisher meddling in editorial affairs. You might ask, should the owner who's concerned with the business matters be the editor-in-chief? But whatever, he was.
Okay, so the editor-in-chief. So you have an ambitious young man, you know, who, and the editor-in-chief and owner, who's a powerful figure in journalism, who could open all sorts of doors, wants a story, and, you know, he decides, well, he'll write the story. And, like, not only did he write it, he, like, you know, fabricated all the juicy details to confirm everything that the editor-in-chief wanted. And so I think that like it's not a personal failure of Stephen Glass. I mean, I hate the fact that the Glass thing is treated as just like, oh, this fabricator and fabulist, rather than an institutional failure of the New Republic, and an institutional failure very much tied to the prejudices of the editor-in-chief. I mean, I think that's what happened.
Well, you mean you think Marty wanted so much to like the story that he overlooked the kind of glaring. I mean, that's possible. I don't know. I don't even, you know, I don't even remember if the story wound up confirming, you know, whatever Marty wanted confirmed. I don't even remember that part of it. I do remember, you know, he asked the question, what happened to all the African American cab drivers, which is in itself, I mean, I think if you're a journalist, any change in society is a legitimate thing to bring attention to and ask, why did this happen? Now, you can say the heathen had his own agenda about what he wanted the moral of the story to be, you know, hardworking Africans, lazy African Americans, whatever he, you know, he may
Yeah,
have
I think
wanted,
that
but
was in the article. That was like the it's like,
what was it?
cab drivers. It's about cab drivers and the work ethic. That's I think that's like literally the title of the article. Like work is in the title. Like, and it's all about how like Africans from Africa have a work ethic, unlike certain people of certain people that we know, and who are shiftless. Like really, I think that I think it's not just like the Marty Peretz was willing to overlook the flaws of the story because it confirmed his prejudice, but also that like if you're a young, ambitious like intern or whatever Glass's status was, a young and ambitious writer, like to give the editor-in-chief the story that he exactly wants is a good career move. I think Glass was a careerist, right? I think that the
Most people I know are, but
Yeah, it didn't work out. His strategy did not work out. But you can kind of see that there's an institutional failure. And I think that ties in with, I mean, okay, so
it was an
I guess we're
institutional failure and an individual failure.
Of course.
I mean, Glass was, I don't know if he's a sociopath or what, but you know, he would just lie to your face, obviously, and at some level, I think was taking delight in it. It was both. It was both. It was clearly an institutional failure at the most elementary level, at least as egregious in a technical sense as the Rolling Stone failure.
I think that's right. Although and I think okay, so we're officially in sort of New Republic
Apparently, and
territory now.
this has been your the grist for your mill lately. So
Oh, okay,
say
good.
some
And
say something.
I should say that, like, friends of mine have, like called for an intervention to get me to stop writing about the New Republic.
I'm trying to do that service for you. I'm hoping this will be cathartic. Just get it
Yeah,
out.
this is
And
like,
if you
I think
look,
watching it
if you
is
need
therapy.
to literally yell, scream, and throw things, if you think that will help get it out of your system, do it. It's great TV. And you know, I think might be good for you.
Well, I think Jerry Springer used to have people throwing around chairs, and I think maybe that's where Flogging Heads TV needs to go
There's a
to.
clock behind you. You want to see some great TV? Grab that clock and throw it at the camera.
Okay, so but I mean, so I was thinking, like, why is the New Republic thing? Not just for me. I mean, like, like Coates at the, who I guess is your colleague at the, or former colleague at the
I'm
Atlantic.
not at the Atlantic anymore, but we were colleagues in that sense.
So your former colleague, has a similar set of concerns, and I think that there's, I mean, okay, I think that there is a partial racial divide here. That I think the sort of nostalgia for the New Republic, the people who, get misty-eyed when they think about like, oh, 1980s New Republic, like, to me that seems like a pretty white crowd. Like, and I don't think like I think that people, especially African Americans or, even someone like me who's like, was born in India, like we're like less likely to like kind of think of that era of the New Republic
Well,
as like,
Fareed Zakaria made his
well,
whatever the metaphor is, made his what do you earned his wings, whatever. I edited a Fareed piece and tried to talk some sense into him. So he's Indian, I think. But anyway, look, it was mainly not only mainly white, it was not only overwhelmingly white, it was overwhelmingly male.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think this is a point that actually James Walcott made in Vanity Fair in the 1980s. Like in 1988, James Walcott noted that like Commentary Magazine had which is like really right wing, and National Review, which is very right wing, had a strong stable of female writers. They had Jean Kirkpatrick, they had Midge Dekter, they had Gertrude Himmelfarb, they had Linda Chavez,
Marty actually
had.
loved to publish all of those women, by the way. They weren't at the New Republic, but I think at least three of those four, and possibly that's his kind of woman. I'm telling you, a neocon. But anyway.
But you were much more likely to find a female byline in Commentary Magazine or in National Review than you were in the New Republic, which is a supposedly liberal magazine. And I think so. I think that so you have so I okay. To maybe take a big picture kind of view of this, those of us who are critical of the New Republic aren't saying it was a bad magazine. Like I think it was actually. I mean, I've been reading, as I mentioned in an earlier conversation, I was reading the New Republic since I was like 14, right? Like so, I've been reading it for like like 30 years now, and it's and it was a very exciting magazine, especially in the 1980s, and a challenging magazine for those of us who are on the left. And I've always, I, you know, I've been, I'm much more politically to the left than the New Republic is, right? But it's like it seemed like a magazine that was like, I always thought of it as a very intelligent conservative magazine. Like I thought, like it's actually, despite the lack of female bylines, it's like a better conservative magazine than National Review or Commentary. It made the conservative case like better than those
Well,
publications
in
did.
the 80s, what you had was two things. You had Marty having real, genuinely conservative instincts, especially neocon instincts on foreign policy, kind of pulling the magazine one way. You had Mike Kinsley, who in many ways, who was the editor when I was, much of the time I was there and when I first arrived, pulling the magazine in another direction. But it's true that on kind of economic policy issues and domestic policy issues, Mike was not some kind of old leftist. He would say he had an appreciation for market forces and things markets could do, and the fact that you had to reckon with the reality of the efficiency of markets and so on. And as a result, he wound up being what was then called a neoliberal, a term that's used in a different sense now. Later came to be called kind of a new Democrat. It was kind of the Charlie Peters Washington Monthly school.
Safari Democrat, I think, was a term that was thrown around at the time.
Okay, so we're back. We had some technical difficulties, but you were about to reply to what I had said.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, well, I mean, I absolutely agree that Michael Kingsley, like, was a new liberal or Atari liberal, as they called it back when they had Atari. But I mean, I'd have to go further. I mean, I think Michael Kingsley actually said that like, if he was living in Britain, he would vote for Margaret Thatcher, right?
Mike
That
said
this.
that.
I'm pretty sure he said that.
I
Like
would
he.
be surprised if he said he would vote for her in some comprehensive way. He might have said on one issue, but we'll let people
Or
get to
he
the bottom of this.
certainly upheld Thatcher as a superior person than Reagan because she was actually applying
Oh
austerity.
well,
That's
maybe would
cutting.
have maybe I'd vote for her over Reagan, maybe, but that one that's
No, I think it went further than that. I actually
well,
think
okay.
like he actually like had
I'd be
a
shocked
real
if he's.
appreciation for like Thatcher as a political ideal, which is so I mean, and so I mean, if that's what
By the
it.
way, Michael Elliott wrote a piece in the New Republic about his fondness for Margaret Thatcher. Possible
Well,
there's confusion here, but anyway.
yeah. Okay. We'll
I
probably
would
leave
be
that. But I mean,
shocked. I would be
that
shocked if
Michael.
Mike said that if he were British, he would vote for her over the Labour candidate. But anyway.
I think that the so certainly, and I think like in terms of like the New Republic as a magazine, like I think that the 80s were a creative period because you had just not just Kingsley but also Hertzberg, Hendrik Hertzberg, who was like a sort of counterforce, and so you had a kind of interesting tension between Martin Peretz's like right wing grift and the sort of like some resistance from Kingsley and even more resistance from Hertzberg. And what I think happened in the 1990s, which is disastrous for the magazine, is that you had editors who didn't challenge Peretz on these matters and actually catered to Peretz and gave him what he wanted. And what you ended up getting was, Andrew Sullivan, who I think was a disaster as editor and who, like, you know, published the infamous bell curve and also the no exit piece on, like, healthcare, which was, like, a terrible article, which had a real political impact.
I mean, a real impact. You know, in those days, a magazine, a single magazine could have a real impact, and the New Republic was kind of the magazine in Washington. That had a real impact on the prospect for Clinton's health care.
And then so and they published this hugely flawed article that had, like, you know, and which was, you know, like, has been definitively debunked, but they gave their, like, sanction to it, and they gave their good name to it. And then later you had you know, the infamous, and Michael Kelly, I think this continued, that you had an editor who, you know, wanted to cater, who shared Peretz's basic worldview and was willing to cater to it and would publish a kind of, you know, welfare reform cover, end it, which had, like, an African American woman smoking with a, you know, like a child, like, as the face of welfare. So I think, like, you know, like, for people like me who are, like, you know, to the left of the New Republic, these are like real, I wouldn't say grievances, but I mean, like they really, like, sort of define what the magazine is. Now, having said that, I acknowledge that the magazine had a lot of other, you know, like, more positive things.
Yeah.
But,
and, you know, one of them, I will say, I was prompted by all of this discussion to go back, to look at my bookshelf. You know, there used to be a tradition when there were real magazines, physical magazines, that when you left, if you had been at the magazine, they would give you hardbound copies of all the magazines that had been published while you were there.
Yeah.
So, and I looked at the Charles Murray thing, and it's an interesting cover because, I mean, first of all, the deal with Charles Murray, all of us, as I recall, were against publishing the excerpt from the book, The Bell Curve, except for the owner and the editor of the magazine, and they won. They did, I guess, to their credit, publish. If you look at this, there's way more people. There's all these responses, I think most of which are critical.
Mm-hmm.
My response actually came in the following issue because I was at that point writing the TRB column on alternate weeks. But I explained why I didn't think we should have published it and why I thought Murray was technically, his argument was technically flawed. And there was a later column that, with all due humility, I think was devastating because it turned out Murray really did not understand the concept of heritability, which is the absolute key concept in the book. And it was on Mike Kinsley's CNN show. He then had a weekly talk show that Murray revealed the fact that he didn't. And I think zeroed in on that successfully. But the main point is there was, I mean, the revolt, the staff revolt wasn't just suppressed, okay? Everyone was given their voice. I would say that, and that does speak to something that I think accounts for some of this nostalgia you're hearing for the old New Republic. And I think some of this has been overwrought personally, the reaction to what's happened at the New Republic. But part of the nostalgia is what that issue reflects was there was this idea: ideas matter. We're going to argue over them. And the editorial meetings were really, there were some really good arguments about a lot of things. And the magazine had an official editorial voice, which it doesn't now. In other words, it published editorials.
Yeah.
So this all mattered. And there were fights. And that part was good. But you're right. You know, there were, you know, you haven't listed all the racial issues culminating in I think the most indefensible remark maybe that's ever been made in the New Republic, which I guess was maybe just on the website. But when Marty said that thing about, what was it, questioning whether Muslims should have First Amendment rights or something, it was just so far off the charts.
Well, there's actually, like, somebody, Matt Duss, set up a website called the Peretz Dossier, where you could find a full counting of all these indefensible remarks by Peretz. And no, the New Republic was a place where arguments happened, which I think is good. And it's a very vital, lively magazine. I mean, with the bell curve thing, though, like you can see it on two sides, right? Like the article that you wrote and that other people wrote challenging the bell curve, I love those articles. I value them. But why did the New Republic have to publish an excerpt of the bell curve? Like, why not let National Review
Yeah,
publish an
look,
excerpt of the
I'm
bell
not,
curve?
I'm the wrong person to ask. I was never in favor of it.
Well, no,
I was
I know
opposed
that's
as I
what
wrote
you
at the
think,
time.
but yeah,
I
I
cannot
know,
give you an
but.
answer. It should not happen.
Yeah, it shouldn't happen. And I think it's especially, and I think this is a point that Coates makes, which I think is very good, which is that if you have an like a magazine that has had in 100 years two black staffers at and then not at like senior positions, right? Like I think and then in the 1990s had like no black staffers. If you if for a magazine like that to publish like things like the bell curve or this the taxi cab article or the end welfare cover and article meant that there's no one inside the magazine who's gonna challenge that, who had the perspective to challenge that, who had the perspective to say like as a liberal magazine, should we be standing for this? And I think it's especially like odd considering the nature of American liberalism, because African Americans, it's not just that liberals support civil rights, but African Americans are a key part of the liberal coalition and have been for like forever. Like, when was the last time a Democratic president won the White House strictly on the white vote, like without like relying on the black vote to put him over the top? Do you know when that was?
I don't know. Is there an actual answer?
1944.
Okay.
So since 1944, the Republicans have gotten the majority of the white vote. Like in
Okay, so we again had technical difficulties, but we're back. Why don't you finish your thought or bring out a new one, as you will.
okay, yeah, no, I just to finish that thought, like African Americans have been a core part of the Democratic coalition since forever. Women and feminists have been a big part of the Democratic coalition since the 60s, and you have a liberal magazine that has like a terrible record on hiring women and African Americans. And I should actually say that this actually has changed specifically under the recent editor who was either quit or fired. Franklin, is
Four.
it Four?
Four.
Yeah, Four.
Yeah.
Yeah, who had who's very much improved the magazine, especially on the gender front. But I mean, I think that the whole New Republic thing as well. Okay, first, so I just want to end also on something about nostalgia, because one of Leon Wieseltier's former assistants wrote a very lovely eulogy for her. But in the eulogy, he quotes something he said, which is, when I go outside my office, it's 2014 or 2114, 2014. But when I go back into my office, it's 1954. And so there's a kind of way in which the New Republic sees itself, or at least Wieseltier does, as a nostalgic operation. And I think that for those of us who are not nostalgic for 1954, who don't think like 1954, it was a world that would have excluded us on all sorts of reasons, like there's a problem with that nostalgia. And so I think that, I'm not saying the New Republic is a bad magazine and let's burn all those back issues that you have in your office. I mean, I'm just saying, we have to question that nostalgia, like, because we're living in the 21st century, and we can't just go back to what the magazine was. And so I
No.
think.
I mean, I think it's certainly fair to try to ask, what were the best things about it and about just magazines of this type, and can we preserve, to what extent can we realistically hope to preserve the good parts in the modern media environment?
Yeah, and I think that that actually goes to this political economy question. And I mean, I'll apologize for this because, I always sound like a Marxist, and it's partially because I am a Marxist.
You're an actual Marxist?
no, I mean, I don't belong to the party, but like I accept a lot of like Marxist
I'm
analysis.
a Marxist on everything but economics. I mean, I think he's right about the way society actually works
Yeah,
in a
yeah,
way,
yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
I suppose I can tell
I would co-sign with that. Yeah.
yeah.
So, anyways, but I mean, I think there's a political economy aspect, which is that the New Republic model is, the Charles Foster Kane model. You find a rich man who will, wants to have fun with a publication, and he'll do it. And the problem
except
is,
Kane made money.
Yeah. Except
he was like Murdoch.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the problem is, if you have Charles Foster Kane, you have to praise his wife singing. If you have Marty Peretz, you have to kind of, go along with Israeli foreign policy and the Iraq war. And if you have Chris Hughes, I mean, we don't know what he stands for, and that itself is a problem. But there are other ways of having an intellectual magazine. And I want to say something which I think is very interesting, which is that the New York Review of Books has made money since 1965.
That's shocking. Well, small, poorly paid staff presumably is the key, right?
I think there's a couple of things that are at work there. I mean, they have a niche, which is like university advertising money, right? Like if you're Harvard University Press, like where else are you going to advertise except the New York Review? They've kept their staff to a minimum. The magazine itself is physically, I mean, it's on newsprint, right? Like it's... They employ a lot of academics, but I think that could all be overstated. Like they actually do real reporting. I mean, Elizabeth Drew writes for them. I think Joan Didion has done reporting for them. Gary Wills. These are people who like actually go out and Michael Danner. People who go out and do like actual reporting and publish in the New York Review, and then the magazine makes money. That's one model. The Nation is another model, and they also have a bit of a wealthy patron in the form of Katrina Vandenhoevel, but not alone. I mean, unlike the New Republic, the Nation does much more funding from small donors, like bringing in like the readership base into the funding. They do things like the Nation Cruise, where you can go out and on a cruise. I guess in the old days with Alexander Coburn and the other staffers, and they have. I think the Nation has like a wine club, a Nation wine club. So there are I think intellectual magazines can find different sources of revenue, and I think that's the way to go. And I think like the problem with the Murdoch model, the Martin Peretz model, the Chris Hughes models is you're putting all your eggs in one basket, right? Like you're really putting yourself at the mercy of a rich man whose whims could change.
Well, I think he's trying. I'm not convinced Hughes is trying to make money. I think he's trying to minimize his losses, which Marty always did as well. And I guess you're saying, hey, that's possible, you can do that. Although there is a problem, which is if you're perceived as being owned by a rich person, I think it's some of these forms of fundraising are harder. Getting people to he just froze up again.
Did we just end it there?
So anyway, you remain frozen.
Yes.
Visually
frozen, yeah.
But
yeah.
Your vibrant voice lives on here and also on Twitter. Where people should follow you. I think you invert your first and last name in your Twitter handle, is that right?
That's right, yeah, because someone else has Jeet here. So I'm actually at Here Jeet.
At Here Jeet. You also write for various publications, but the place people can go right now to read you is Twitter. So thanks a lot.
I run the Leon Wieseltier fan club. We hold monthly meetings with a little shrine towards...
Yeah, I noticed you were skeptical of that that ode to Leon that appeared in the week.
Yeah.
We wisely steer away from this subject during the course of this conversation. Time we'll get these technical problems ironed out before you come back. Okay.
I'm gonna. My IT staff is working on it right now.
Even as we speak.
Yeah, even as we speak. I think maybe there's some people at the New Republic who.
The finest minds at the New Republic are on this case.
Okay. Good. So we'll talk again soon.
Okay. See you, Jeet.